Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. With just 7 months to go until the November elections, Republican efforts are focused on trying to take back the House and Senate. But the road to victory will not be an easy one. With 29 members retiring from the House and 5 from the Senate, the party has its work cut out. Here to join the discussion for the GOP's chances of regaining the majority this fall, Charlie Cook, the Cook Political Report, and Norman Ornstein, the American Enterprise Institute. Joining us by phone from Philadelphia is Benjamin Wallace Wells of Rolling Stone. He wrote a cover story on the state of the Republican Party, which appeared in yesterday's edition of the New York Times Magazine. And, of course, throughout the hour, you'll be part of the program with your questions, comments. Join us by phone at 800-433-8850 or send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, all.
Morning, Diane.
Morning.
Nice to see you. Benjamin, let me start with you in Philadelphia. I know you talked with a lot of people in the Republican Party, including Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma. Tell me what you took away from those conversations.
Well, I think that the piece that we did was sort of driving and answering one central question, which is, you know, what is the legacy of the 2006 election? Tom Cole talks about the upcoming election for Congress and says, you know, Democrats right now have 60 representatives sitting in seats that George Bush won in 2004. So we think that that makes them very vulnerable. By contrast, Republicans have only 8 members sitting in seats that John Kerry won in 2004. The question that comes up then is which election, 2006 or 2004, better represents the kind of basic instincts of those districts. And if the 2006 election better represents the instincts of those districts, then you're looking at a political map that's beginning to change.
So you would say that after all this, you've seen that the Republican Party is certainly in a state of flux.
Yeah, I think it's in a state of some real flux and some real sort of casting about for a new direction and some answers, and there's not one that's readily apparent. I think that in the immediate aftermath of 2006, there were a lot of people who thought, you know, maybe that was a special event, and that in 2008 and moving forward, the party would, you know, if not regain the majority, at least, you know, come very close. And right now, it's hard to find a lot of people who think that way.
Norm Ornstein, has the Republican Party come to terms with why it lost the election in 2006?
You know, inside Congress, you get a lot of born-again spirit, certainly built around, for example, this drive to abolish earmarks, at least for the year, and to take the pledge. An enormous irony here. The earmarks, of course, have been in existence for a very long time. They took a dramatic increase under the Republicans and especially under Tom DeLay, a very deliberate decision, ironic, of course, for the conservatives running government, to vastly expand the reach of government so that they could protect some of their members and build a permanent majority, and also so that the leaders could have some leverage. So the number of earmarks doubled and almost doubled again. The amount went to a very large sum, depending on how you want to define it, $50 or $60 billion. Now we have Republicans saying, no more, we've learned our lessons. We also have them talking about bringing back rules of fairness in Congress, something which they pretty much threw out in the majority. It's hard to take a lot of this seriously, frankly. If they were back in the majority, the idea that we would suddenly have a new, reformed, and clean body, it just doesn't work. But frankly, Diane, this is a part of what a minority party does to try and highlight the excesses of the majority. And if you lose, you try and go right back at the ones who've taken power as doing just what you did and being hypocritical about it. And that's what we're seeing.
Charlie Cook, where did Republicans lose their support in 2006?
I guess if I were trying to quantify what role various things played in 2006, earmarks would be somewhere around 3%. I mean, you had a lot of war in there. You had a lot of scandal. You had a lot of just sort of generic anti-President Bush feeling. You had a little bit of earmarks, a little bit of some of the sort of arrogance of power that Norm was talking about. But it was a big mix, but the war was probably half of it, and scandals at least another quarter of it. But I guess where if I had Tom Cole's job, I would make the same argument he's making. But the reason it's not terribly credible to me is that while the 2004 results on a district-by-district basis might be a useful scale, the fact is President Bush couldn't carry half the districts that he won. I mean, we just saw a special election in Illinois. Here's a district that he won by something like 11 percentage points. He had a 59% disapproval in a heavily Republican district that Republicans lost by 4 percentage points. 59% disapproval in a district he carried by 11. That's unbelievable. We're talking about places like my home state of Louisiana. A year ago, nobody would be talking about Democrats potentially picking up a pair of seats in Louisiana. Today, there's a pretty good chance of that. My guess is we're going to be looking at Democrat gains of, 10, 12, 15, which isn't a huge number, except that when you're doing on top of 30, that is a big number.
Benjamin says in his piece that Congressman Cole wants his candidates to run as insurgents this year. Benjamin, what did you take out of that statement?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a paradox right there, and this isn't something that I discovered. This is something that Cole has been saying, very loudly and again and again. But the paradox is that there's still Cole's right that there is a lot of disapproval out there with the way that Congress has behaved, and their approval ratings are very low. But the problem is that a lot of that disapproval began under Republican power. And so what Cole has to do is sort of invert the case and convince voters that, that the things that they're frustrated with Congress for belong, they should blame Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic Congress for, as opposed to the Republican Congress that only left power a year ago. And that's a tough ask.
Benjamin Wallace Wells, he's a writer for Rolling Stone. He wrote the cover story for the New York Times Magazine yesterday, titled The End of Republican America, and that's with a question mark at the end. Here in the studio, Charlie Cook. He's editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report, and Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Norm Ornstein, what about money? How much does the Republican Party have a money problem this election?
For the congressional seats, even for the presidential campaign, it's a huge problem. And, Tom Cole, whom I know well and is a wonderful guy, has the worst of all possible circumstances to deal with. The Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, the official arm of the House Republicans raising money for their candidates, has struggled to raise any money and now faces an enormous scandal one of their top people they'd hired to keep their books absconded allegedly and apparently with a very substantial sum of money. We don't know quite how much yet, and he also managed a number of individual candidates' coffers. So they're in the hole, and of course, raising money when you've got one of your top people having siphoned off a substantial amount doesn't become very easy under those circumstances.
What are we talking about in the way of amounts?
It's at least $1 million and possibly more. then you've got the difficulty of raising money when you're in the minority, and almost everybody believes you're still going to be in the minority. Democrats managed to do much better raising money going into 2006 than they did in 2004 because a lot of lobbyists and other interests want access insurance. If they think you're going to be in the majority, you get more money. So, and you've got more open seats because of so many departures, and you don't have incumbents with the incumbent machine raising money.
So,
big problem.
Charlie, how is that likely to have an effect on John McCain in November?
Well, we're just seeing a general demoralization within the Republican Party. And financially speaking, it's manifesting itself on the presidential level where, you know, you look at all the Republican field together, and they were not competitive with either Senators Clinton or Obama. And Senator McCain, even now that he's nailed down the nomination, is not raising money in the same levels that Clinton and McCain are, or Clinton and Obama are. You look at the party committees, and with the exception of the RNC raising more money than the DNC, but the margin is less than it usually is. By every metric, Democrats are outraising Republicans. You had Democratic turnout in the primaries at higher levels. The Republicans were, sometimes they were hitting records, but the Democrats were hitting like records plus, plus, plus. And you just have a general, I haven't seen the Republican Party this demoralized since Watergate.
Would you agree with that, Norm?
I think absolutely. There's they're getting a little more energized now as McCain has an open field and perhaps an opportunity. And they're trying to get energized by getting hepped up about the Democratic nominee. You know, make the Democrat the devil figure. It's not a difficult thing for them to do with Hillary Clinton. They're trying with Barack Obama. But there's a high level of demoralization. And inside Congress, you see it with the retirements and you see it, frankly, with the slumped shoulders.
And you see it, for example, NBC and the Wall Street Journal in their poll about a month ago, they asked voters on a scale of 1 to 10, how interested are you in this upcoming election? And there was like a 12-point spread for Democrats, and Gallup had some enthusiasm numbers that were saying, my sister calls this electoral dysfunction.
Charlie Cook, the Cook Political Report. We'll take just a short break. We'll come back and take your comments, questions. Stay with us. Just before the break, we were talking about money in this Republican year of concern about these elections. Norm Ornstein, where is the money going to come from to help these Republican candidates run?
Well, the only place that they're going to be able to find that could possibly compensate is outside groups. There are some well-heeled conservatives and Republicans who've begun to create outside organizations. You know, we call some of them 527s for the area of the tax code that allows organizations to be put together for political purposes. There's another loophole here, 501c4, which is a nonprofit organization, but one that can get involved in issue advocacy. And with a more permissive Supreme Court now, after Sandra Day O'Connor retired, where you don't have to disclose some of those nominations and you can't be a political organization targeting candidates, they're going to put some money into ads to try and soften Democrats up at an early stage. Hard to do it later on. And frankly, I think given the demoralization in the ranks of donors as well as of the candidates and voters, they're just not going to easily be able to compete with the Democratic enthusiasm on this front.
Benjamin, did you encounter that same demoralization over the money issue?
Yeah, and I think one thing that's interesting about these outside groups like Freedom's Watch, when I first started reporting the story back in, you know, December and January, you'd talk to Republicans on the Hill, and there was, you know, great enthusiasm about the possible role that these groups could play and the huge, you know, pots of money that were out there waiting to weigh in on the conservative side and the Republican side. And you'd hear people talking about, you know, the 60 staffers that Freedom's Watch, which is probably the most prominent of these groups, had just hired. But, you know, the role that they're going to play seems to be a little bit more like an open question right now. And you know, you hear a little bit less of that, you know, great enthusiasm and great promise among Republican staffers, at least I do, right now. So, you know, we'll see, but that's certainly the hope that they have and the kind of the open variable that's out there.
Bill Kristol has a piece in the New York Times this morning in which he talks about Senator McCain's Nationwide Service to America campaign. Is that likely to raise donors around the country, Charlie?
No. I mean, I don't think it's going to be much. I don't think it's going to be that big a deal. I mean, the thing is, you're going to have, as Norm said, some 527s, some 501c4s, and they will make up. But I haven't seen that much enthusiasm within the party for, you know, financially for anything or anybody. And, you know, I think the best thing you can say for Republicans is that money isn't everything. I mean, it sort of helps. But before we completely bury and say prayers for the Republican Party, I think it's important to remember that both political parties have enormous self-destructive tendencies. And you give either party the presidency, the House and the Senate, and it's a ticking time bomb. And when Democrats took over everything in 92, first midterm election, they blew it up and lost the House and the Senate. It took Republicans their fourth time. I mean, they won, they got everything in 2000, and by 2006, they blew it up. You know, you give Democrats the presidency, the House, the Senate, and it's only a matter of time before they overreach and blow it too.
You know, Diane, I've been talking to a number of the House Republicans who are already, frankly, focused on 2010. You know, because they're anticipating the possibility that the strong possibility that they lose the White House and Democrats have all the reins of power. And they're looking back to what happened after Bill Clinton got himself into that position in 1993. The 1994 elections, of course, were the disaster of the century for Democrats. They lost the House for the first time in 40 years. They lost the Senate. They lost by huge margins. 2010 becomes important in a couple of ways. It's the potential comeback for Republicans with the natural way in which we readjust. It's also a pivotal year because the redistricting for the next 10 years will follow. And so the stakes are going to be very high. And what makes this critical is even as we move beyond the election issues, governing in 2009 becomes more difficult because Republicans in the minority are going to have not the incentives that might otherwise be there to work across party lines. They're going to want to have the do-nothing Congress to run against in 2010.
Benjamin, did Congressman Cole talk at all about a running mate for John McCain and whether that might make any difference at all?
I think that his hopes were hitched more precisely to McCain himself, and I think that, you know, the idea that you might have a different kind of face at the top of the ticket was very attractive to him, or at least that's what he said. You know, he talked rather extensively about the problems of President Bush at this point, which are no secret. But he said, you know, at this point, he's basically his appeal is basically regional. It's basically confined to the South and some of the Plains states, kind of, you know, real conservative heartland. With McCain, you have a figure who's maybe more attractive to, you know, suburban voters in the Midwest and in the Pacific Northwest and parts of the Northeast, to military veterans and to military voters, and so his hope rested more on McCain and sort of the idea that he might broaden and reframe the Republican Party's natural appeal.
I was particularly struck by one quote in your piece yesterday from Congressman Cole. Of course, he's the Republican Campaign Committee chair. He said, quote, "I don't need the nominee to win.
Yeah.
I just need him to be competitive enough that we can win behind him in places that should be ours. I need him to be Gerald Ford."
Right. I mean, I think that that's a pretty accurate gauge of the expectations of the Republican Party, that, you know, that what they're hoping for is for John McCain to be Gerald Ford. It's not saying, you know, I hope he can be Abe Lincoln here.
But what does that
mean? What a level of enthusiasm.
Yeah, what does that mean, Norm?
You know, the problem, I think, here is that I believe and have for a long time that John McCain would be the strongest Republican candidate to win a presidential nomination in a bad year. But he is not going to be a strong candidate for Republicans in Congress. He runs away from the party in a way that doesn't provide that enthusiasm for a significant part of the base. And if he's going to win, he's going to be attracting people because of his independence. These are not people who are going to come to the polls, vote for John McCain, and then look down ticket to vote for Republicans. Exactly the opposite, in fact.
And are they all running away from President Bush, Charlie?
Well, or running sort of parallel, separately. I mean, running away would imply they're trashing him. Well, they're not going to trash him. They're just going to sort of ignore the fact that there is a Republican in the White House and just sort of do their own thing. I mean, I think the good news for Republicans is that their voters are probably going to turn out. Their turnout, voter turnout, really wasn't off much in 06. And gosh knows, after Mark Foley and everything else, there was every reason in the world for them, all the other scandals, for them not to show up. I think they'll show up. And I think that McCain's strength for Republicans is he just sort of breaks things up. He doesn't make anything worse. And as a result, you know, it makes things less awful.
All right, let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Diane.
Morning.
The Republicans have always used the Southern strategy in all those wedge issues, such as race and abortion and prayer in school and immigration. So I was wondering if the panel could think that those issues are kind of losing their luster, especially with young people and young voters that are coming into the fore today. And Norman, I'd like to just ask you, if you don't mind, I loved your book and I love your insight on the Congress. Are you comfortable working for the American Enterprise Institute? I was just curious, Norm.
To answer that, one thing, I wrote a column in the New Republic back over the summer, which was kind of a story of why I ended up at AEI 30 years ago and why I'm still there. And I am comfortable because I've got a lot of interesting colleagues who actually don't fit a line that you might imagine, and because I have an enormous amount of freedom to do what I want to do, and nobody ever tells me I can't do it or asks me why I could possibly take that position. So I certainly don't have a problem there. Just a quick comment on the wedge issue. Race obviously might be a significant issue this time, as gender might. But the social issues as they played out in 2004, those voters in economically depressed areas in Ohio, for example, who went against what we would view as their strong economic interest to vote for George Bush, driven more by the social issues. Hispanics in Florida who did the same thing. It's very unlikely we're going to have that in 2008.
Benjamin, what did you glean from your interviews about those wedge issues?
I think that there's a real sense of not quite fear, but a sense among Republican operatives that, you know, something will have to shift in the medium term. That though abortion retains its power as an issue among younger voters, that things like gay marriage and some of the other social wedge issues that we've talked about are fading, that younger voters have a more libertarian or liberal sensibility on some of those issues. And so the party is going to need to do some rethinking about the way it phrases itself and the degree to which it counts upon those kinds of appeals.
This is Charlie. I agree with Benjamin. I think that Republicans are on the cusp of losing a whole generation. And just as Democrats, when President Reagan swept in, a whole generation of voters that were very, very comfortable with the Republican Party. And I think that President Bush has the potential and Republicans have the potential to drive away this generation that's kind of coming online politically right now. And Benjamin's right. They are very, very libertarian. I think you're going to have to see the Republican Party become a little bit more secular, not changing their positions, but just downplaying cultural issues. Go more of the Eisenhower, Taft, Nixon, Ford, Bush one route rather than the high priority on cultural issues.
And here's an email to that effect from David, who says, please discuss how the current administration's attitudes towards Americans will affect the GOP's chances. If I were a Democrat running for office, I would use a simple poster of Dick Cheney with the one word, so, referring to his interview a couple of weeks ago when he basically stated what everyone knows, this administration does not care about the American public. Do you agree with that, Norm?
It's not clear to me how much, even though there will be a backlash against the Bush and Cheney record, they're not doing very well right now, how much that will play as we look ahead. That, of course, was a reflection of the, at least the underlying sense that we're going to pursue what we think is right, whatever the American people feel, but phrased in a way that really did not help them, and that won't help their cause.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Pleasant Grove, North Carolina. Good morning, Robert.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hello. I'd like to say that the only thing that I can see that this Republican administration has done well is explode all the Republican myths about fiscal responsibility, being able to handle strategic and statecraft. They're corrupt. They have all the things that the Republicans like to pride themselves on. This administration has proven once again that Republicans are the last group of people that have any competence or any inclination to handle or do anything that's good for this country. Just like every Republican administration for my entire lifetime has done nothing but raise the national debt to a higher level than it's ever been in history. Every time, the fact that this credit crunch is just kind of like the savings and loan scandal, and lo and behold, look who the big prominent names are and the big prominent businesses. The corruption that is just wrecking this country. Their free trade policies are wrecking this country.
Charlie.
I think a word, Robert used the word I've been sort of using is, to me, each party has a core value. And for Democrats, it's compassion. For Republicans, it's competence. That you expect Democrats to be compassionate, you expect Republicans to be competent. I think that competence value has been damaged some in the last few years, and whether it's Katrina or Iraq or spending or deficits or scandals or whatever. And I think that's actually, I know this show is not about presidential politics particularly, but why Mitt Romney particularly missed the boat, where he had the opportunity to run for the Republican presidential nomination as the competence, the smart competence manager. And instead, he decided to try to be the most ideological Republican in the race, the most conservative, which if you're a former governor of Massachusetts is a fairly ridiculous thing to do anyway. But the thing is, he ran against what I thought could have been the value, the key core value for him and for his party. But I think Republicans need to move back towards restoration of that competence value, because as people do, that is the strength they see in Republicans historically.
Benjamin, any comment?
You know, one of the people we talked to in the article is this guy Dan Mattoon, who's a Republican lobbyist and sort of longtime Republican insider, and he talked about the erosion over time of the historic three legs of the Republican stool, the three kind of values and political pitches on which the party's appeal had historically been based. One was anti-communism, for which anti-terrorism has been a much weaker substitute. One was small government, which the party, as the caller, you know, adeptly put it, has the party itself has permitted to erode. And the third are these social issues, which have a sort of diminishing appeal generationally. And so that's a really basic challenge for the party. You know, how do we reconstitute ourselves at a moment when the three things we've historically stood for seem to, you know, either by our own doing or by circumstances, have less appeal? And sure, the competence brand is strong, but it requires a party that can articulate it. And for the last few years, they've as Charlie said, they've had huge trouble with that.
You know, Diane, a few interesting things have been going on in the last couple of weeks. One is the bailout of Bear Stearns, and now Republicans struggling to cope with their sort of natural instinct not to get government more involved, in this case to bail out mortgage holders who face foreclosures. And then they're caught in a crossfire. You can bail out the $1 billion-a-year investment bankers, but not the average person. And that's hit John McCain and candidates a little bit lower down. Then look at the litany of stories below the fold on the front page. Apparently, Alfonso Jackson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, is on the verge of resigning. We've had a series of allegations of scandals there, including steering contracts in Philadelphia away from a housing authority to somebody else. We've got this Department of Defense story, this bizarre story of sending these nuclear, top-secret nuclear detonators to Taiwan, and then not even knowing they were missing for a year or more.
They were helicopter parts.
Yeah. We've got the state, and then, you know, telling them to destroy them, basically, because they were the wrong ones. Then we've got the State Department outsourcing passports to Thailand, you know, the most sensitive information, not to mention, of course, having the presidential candidates' information. Information access. Not a good picture to have as a competent government.
Short break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. More calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University and by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Roger Mudge, here's a look back at the glory days of television news, how scoops and rivalries animated the famed CBS Washington Bureau of the 60s and 70s. He calls it the place to be. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about what's happening in the Republican camp, where it's becoming increasingly difficult for candidates to raise money, for candidates to get a concrete and coherent message out, you know, this democracy needs two viable parties. You can't just have one party with all the money, one party with all the power. But inevitably, invariably, it seems that that's what happens from cycle to cycle. And you worry for the democracy itself when that happens, Norm.
But usually what happens, Diane, is that there's a natural phenomenon, partly because of the self-destructive tendencies of each of the parties, that brings it back to some level of equilibrium.
Yeah, but we've got to get to a point where they can work together. Benjamin, I hear you laughing.
Oh, no, I just thought it was a charming point. The reason, you know, it's not just the self-destructive tendencies of the parties. I mean, those self-destructive tendencies come about because they actually have beliefs and they actually have constituencies that they have to obey. And this isn't a, this isn't a country where you can get 80% of people agreeing on most contested issues. And so, I think that there is a kind of tendency, and we see it, we had 12 years of Republican dominance. It seemed like it would last forever. And now that's over, and now maybe you have a new era, but that new era isn't going to last forever either. And so, I do think that there is this kind of equilibrative tendency in the electorate, and that's sort of part of the function of a two-party system. And so, what we've got right now, I think, is just a sort of little bit of a lag, and presumably the Republican Party will figure out how to pick up more votes in the near future. The question for me is sort of where are those votes going to come
yeah.
from, and how will the party have to reconstitute itself to get back?
All right, let's go to Elaine, who's in, how do I pronounce that town in Michigan, Elaine?
It's Dowagiac.
Dowagiac. I'm glad you told me. Go ahead.
Well, you were just talking about my question, and that is, what's the chance for some kind of or measure of bipartisanship, of working together? I don't see it, and I only see it getting worse. And John Adams said that partisanship would be the ruin of this country, and I'm really concerned that we send people to Washington, they get there, and they can't work together. It seems to me that the country should be more important than either party.
Charlie Cook?
Well, let me just ask, if Elaine's still, where is Dowagiac? I'm curious.
It's in the southwest corner of the state. It's about 25 miles north of Notre Dame.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you. I was just absolutely perplexed. The thing is, look, this presidential race in November, it's a 50-50, you know, but give or take 5%. And
you mean between Republicans and Democrats?
Yeah, I think McCain's got a 50-50 chance of beating, whether it's Obama or Clinton, probably Obama. And it's going to be very close. And there's about a 99% chance that the Congress is going to be Democratic. And so what we've got is something pretty close to a 50-50 chance that you're going to have a McCain president and a Democratic Congress. And if you were going to find if you were going to come up with a configuration where it might work, you know, a McCain president, because he is such a free agent, I mean, to the consternation of a lot of Republicans, he is, and a Democratic Congress, and let's face it, Pelosi has been a lot better than a lot of people predicted that she would be, and she's been a lot more pragmatic than a lot of people predicted to be, I think it's the potential for a very interesting configuration, if things align that way.
Here's the good news. The parties have opted through this long and difficult process for candidates whose theme is we will transcend the differences and bring the country together. That has been the most powerful theme of Barack Obama. And John McCain is the one Republican whose record is filled with instances where he worked with people across party lines. The difficulty is that this next Congress is going to have sharper polarization. The Republicans who are leaving, the Republicans who are loose, are more often than not members of what I call the problem-solving caucus, whatever their ideology they want to reach across the lines. They're going to be replaced in many cases by either harder-edged Republicans or by Democrats who tend to be more liberal. The Democrats who are vulnerable and the ones who are leaving seats like Alabama with Kramer tend to be the more moderate ones as well. So it's going to be difficult to do in this environment, difficult because of 2010, but we are likely to have a president whose inclination from the beginning is to find that golden mean somewhere across party lines.
I'm so glad you mentioned Alabama, Norm, because this morning we want to welcome listeners at WBHM in Birmingham, as well as listeners throughout North Central Alabama, to the Diane Rehm Show. We thank you for listening, and I look forward to hearing from you. All right, let's go now to Dave, who's in Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I had a question for the panelists. I wanted to get their take on what they thought of the demographic shift in America, that being that the white population is becoming smaller and smaller relative to the rest of the population, And doesn't that doom the Republican Party, given that there's such a close correlation between white people voting Republican?
You know, with President Bush and Karl Rove being vilified as they have, you know, this is the one thing where President Bush, Karl Rove, McCain, Matthew Dowd, when he was the chief strategist of the Bush campaign in 2004, were preaching, is that, you know, the number of white males is getting proportionally smaller in this country, and if the Republican Party is going to survive in the long haul, they're going to have to do better among Hispanics, because they clearly aren't among African Americans. And unfortunately for Republicans, a lot of people in their party didn't go along with them, and they have really turned away Hispanic voters in a massive way. They've sort of done nationally what Pete Wilson did in California back in the early mid-'80s, and that's why if you're a Republican and really want to worry about the long haul, think about, A, the generational, and B, the Hispanics.
And think about immigration, Norm.
And the immigration issue has, I think, is one where clearly the president and Karl Rove saw an opportunity to try and solidify Hispanic support. Hispanics who in this country tend to be social conservatives, very patriotic, large numbers who've served in the military, but given the hard line that the Republican Party in the primary process took on immigration, that's been a challenge to them. But here again, John McCain has a somewhat different viewpoint. And part of the question is how much McCain will harden his edge on the immigration issue to try and bring that base back during this campaign and maybe create additional problems, at least for 2008, with some of those Hispanic voters.
Here's an email from Bill, who says, while the Democrats are almost certain to pick up seats in the House and Senate, there is a good possibility John McCain could win the White House. This would produce a situation where one party wins the presidency while losing seats in Congress, something I can't recall ever occurring before. How unprecedented.
It happened in 2000, where the Republicans lost seats in both houses, four, I believe, in each. It happened in 1960, actually. The Republicans picked up seats in Congress when John Kennedy came in. It has happened before. It is not a typical occurrence.
Benjamin, here's a question for you from Mike in Connecticut. He says there are two words explaining why the Republican Party is in such dire straits. President Bush and his administration have been an unmitigated disaster on every level, and voters are sick of him and his party. Benjamin, did you hear that?
Yeah, and one thing that you hear from the Democrats, who are, you know, the people running the DCCC and the other organizations that will work to put Democrats, to keep Democrats in control of Congress, is that they're going to spend every dime that they can get their hands on to keep President Bush's face and record, you know, on the air and part of the conversation in all of these competitive congressional districts. And one of the things that is sort of going to be, a sort of secret competition in this election is, you know, how much President Bush remains the face of the party and how much John McCain is able to, you know, who again is a much more, you know, inclusive and at this point popular figure, how much he's able to be the face of the Republican Party. Seems like a hard thing for me, though, to see Bush's record being, you know, completely eradicated as part of this debate. It seems like, you know, that's going to be a big part of how this election is contested.
Charlie.
My job isn't to defend President Bush here, but I think there's some co-ownership of some of the Republican Party's problems. I mean, some of the excesses of Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay, the Jack Abramoff scandal, all the way up through Mark
Terry
Foley.
Terry Schiavo.
There was a lot of damage done to the Republican brand on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And that's why one of the reasons why, yes, Congress has a horribly low approval rating, but Republicans, even though they're in the minority, they still have some co-ownership in the public's mind of a lot of the problems that are inherent in Congress.
The other thing, of course, taxes. Here's an email from Craig, who says, what the Republican Party was very good at selling the American public was conservative values such as boundaries on gay marriage and abortions. The administration sold us a policy that tax breaks for the wealthy would stimulate the economy so jobs would be created and people would have jobs. The reality of what's happened for Republicans is in setting up the economic policy of removing taxes from the wealthy, which has allowed for the societal character defect of greed to run rampant, Norm.
You know, when an economy is running strong, that's not a terribly potent political issue. Most Americans aren't rich, but they want to be rich, and they think their children can be rich. So running against the wealthy doesn't often work. When an economy is in trouble, it's a different matter. There's a fairly strong populist movement out there, and it's another one of the reasons why, getting back to what we were talking about earlier with the bailout of Bear Stearns, it's really a slippery slope to be on to try and defend that while not doing anything about the average person.
To Jerry in St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was a great admirer of Senator Hagel until he appeared on your show last week, and I think we got a tip off of some of the strategies when he mentioned that the next president would be facing, and he brought up numerous challenges, and then also the high level of partisanship, as if this had happened in a vacuum. And to the partisanship issue, I think it reached new heights with the 2006 elections to hear the president say that if the Republicans lost, the terrorists won. And I think that brings it, you know, that's a very high level of acrimony, and it would be hard to pull back from that.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Senator Hagel was on this program last week talking about why he is leaving the Congress and talking about the incredible difficulty of working together across party lines on the Hill, Charlie.
And he is, he is one of the Mavericks, and you hear he's a refreshing guy, but you look at a Hagel and say, how could anybody like that win their party's nomination? And the thing is, John McCain is probably the closest thing to a total maverick that you could get winning a party nomination. But, you know, he is, I think the war in Iraq sort of demonstrated his purity and sort of was one of the things that enabled him, ironically, to get the Republican nomination that normally he may not have done that.
Let's now go to Michael, who's in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Go right ahead, sir.
Pardon me?
Go right ahead, please.
Okay. I want to comment on a couple of things. The first one is the remark that Cheney made when he was interviewed, when he said, so, and one of your panelists who attempted to explain away what he really meant. You know, Cheney is one of the few people in the Bush administration who says what he means and means what he says. I mean, the one thing this gentleman does not have trouble with is articulating a perspective or a viewpoint. President Bush, that's another matter. But if Cheney said it, that's what he meant. And he made no effort, either at the time of that interview or later, to try to, you know, change what he said, to say to anyone what he really meant. He said exactly what he meant. And that also is an indicator of the continued contempt he has, not just for the middle class and average Americans and poor people, but also for those soldiers who are dying in Iraq.
Benjamin, how much did Vice President Cheney come up in your discussions with Republicans?
Well, not all that much. But one thing that I think is sort of interesting about this point is, and you know, without suggesting that the listeners and callers to the Diane Rehm Show are a perfect proxy for the voting instincts of the public, but, you know, as much as we talk about the election and politics pitching forward and sort of grappling with new issues and the ways in which, you know, a McCain candidacy might, you know, put some of the Bush policies and administration and characters behind the Republicans, and as much as the Republicans hope for that, you know, the thing you hear on call-in shows and you know, another fora where people are making themselves heard on politics is a sort of, you know, a constant return to what happened during the Bush administration and what was the cause of those problems. And so I think that as much as Republicans are kind of hoping to put all that behind them, you know, I mean, I don't think that that's where most people are, and I think you hear that even in the character of the questions that we're getting on this show.
Norm, briefly, how much of a possibility do you see that many of those vacating seats by Republicans in Congress are going to be won by Democrats?
I think if you look at the roughly 30 seats that are being vacated, you've got 15 or more that are seriously in play. And those are the battlegrounds more than the incumbents losing. And Democrats ought to pick up a significant number of them. And on the other side, the vacant Democratic seats, there are very few, one or two opportunities that Republicans have. That's why they're likely to pick up seats.
Norman Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute. Charlie Cook, he's editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. And Benjamin Wallace Wells, he's a writer for Rolling Stone. He wrote the cover story for the New York Times Magazine yesterday, titled "The End of Republican America with a Question Mark." Thank you all so much.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.